Hey guys, just a heads up that this episode has a couple of little sound things. We lost a couple seconds of audio a few times in this episode that we could not salvage. It's not my bad editing skills, I promise you. I tried to make it sound as good as possible, but unfortunately they're there and you might notice them. Otherwise, this episode is pretty darn great though, so enjoy.
Fellow fiends, welcome to another terrifying and delectable episode of Nightmare on Film Street. The horror podcast with zero credibility, but all of the blood, ghouls, and gore your puny heart can handle. Let's give a grave welcome to our hosts, John and Kim.
Hello again, fiends, and welcome to Nightmare on Film Street. I'm Kim.
I'm John.
And this week, we are talking Revenge of the Remake.
That's right. This week, we are talking about 2010's Nightmare on Elm Street and 2009's Friday the 13th.
Believe it or not, I put these movies on our 31 Days of Halloween movie marathon, just coinciding it with this week's episode. I had it listed as a double feature for Thursday night, and everyone was so mad. I'm very interested to see how the response is for this episode, because a lot of people do not like these movies.
Yeah, and, you know, I feel like we've been defending them for a long time, mostly based on our memories and impressions of these films. So this episode's been a revelation, in my opinion, of both of these movies. It was fun to revisit. I think I came out of it with a completely different opinion.
Oh, totally. We hadn't watched these movies since they came out. We own both of them. We bought them on DVD. I don't think we've watched them since 2010.
I will say that I do occasionally put on the Friday the 13th.
Well, I do occasionally not pay attention.
I really only, now that I've rewatched that entire movie, I think I only ever pay attention to the cold open. Like, I watch the first 20 minutes intently, and after that, it's just background noise.
Yeah, and then there's the Nightmare on Elm Street remake. So we're going to talk about those movies at great length later on in the episode. Before we do that, we are going to get into what's keeping us creepy this week. We have been back from Fantastic Fest for almost 2 weeks now. We are finally getting cold free. We have been sick for a really long time, and this was our first opportunity to record this.
Yeah, I mean, everything's bigger in Texas, including the colds, obviously.
Oh my God.
I feel like it's probably just that it was the summertime and everything's humid and everything is.
And there are
just
germs that Canadians don't understand.
Yeah, like we couldn't get the handshake right. We couldn't figure shit out and like with the bacteria, and yeah, we're done. Dead. We heard everybody coughing and sniffling and we laughed at them for days, and then it came for us.
Yeah, and I've been sick for a while. But, you know, it's fine. We're better. We saw a ton of great movies. Fantastic Fest is a really cool down-to-earth festival, and there's so many fun parties and events. John, what was your favorites from the film festival?
You know, the unfortunate part about this segment is that we do not have enough time to talk about all the movies I want to talk about.
Like, you get one, John.
I basically get one, and then a few big ones that we need to talk about. If I could recommend one movie to you guys in particular, I would absolutely recommend One Cut of the Dead. You've maybe heard of it. It is a zombie movie that has a very long segment that is one cut, one take, a zombie film within a zombie film. It is so strange, so weird, so funny and surprising. And if you've heard everybody say nothing but good things about it, it's because we all have nothing but good things to say about this movie. It is so great. And I don't say that about zombie movies ever.
My pick is The Guilty. It is a very quiet thriller. It's about a 911 operator. Actually, he's not even a 911 operator.
Let's not get into details.
Let's just say he's a cop who is sitting in as a 911 operator. It all takes place on one night. It's one particular phone call. It's one setting. It's very, very good.
The alternate title was One Cop of the Dead.
Shut up. So tense. Definitely one of my standouts from the festival.
I feel very bad. I feel like there's just so many movies we're leaving out. But bigger movies. There was a secret screening, and surprise, surprise, it was the new Suspiria.
Yeah, so I think unpopular opinion, we're mostly eh about it. We didn't love it. It does have some really cool things, which we'll talk about definitely as the wide release comes up. You can read our review at the website, as well as our review on all of the other Fantastic Fest films that we caught. There is a ton of them.
Oh, so many good movies, too. Like, the curation of this festival is incredible. Like, you guys, if you think that, like, oh, I haven't found any great festival movies, they were all at Fantastic Fest.
Yeah, so those reviews are at nofspodcast.com. Just hit that review bar and all of them will pull up.
Obviously, Halloween was playing. It was the opening film. We saw it at TIFF. Looking very much forward to seeing it again in the theater. But Overlord was the other big world premiere at the festival. It's coming out this November, and it is as good as you hope it to be. Like, the trailer is so balls-to-the-wall crazy, and this whole movie is exactly the same. I can't wait for you guys to see this movie. I had a hell of a time watching it. The monsters are great. Like, fucking the sound design in this movie is incredible. Like, go see this movie in the theater solely because of all of the audio and visual. What am I trying to say?
I don't know.
Yeah, it's definitely a theater movie. It's a lot of fun. It's not going to win an Oscar this year for best original screenplay, but if you're looking for a really cool World War II monster movie, this is it.
Yeah, and we also caught Bad Times at the El Royale, which is Drew Goddard of Cabin in the Woods' new movie. It is being described as a Quentin Tarantino-esque film. It's an ensemble crime thriller set in the El Royale, which is a hotel that's past its heyday. And a bunch of stuff happens because everybody's lives entwine, and there's crime and guns and all kinds of fun stuff. And I really liked the film, probably more so than John.
I'm lukewarm on it. It was fine.
I thought it was really great, but I'm not that I'm not a Quentin Tarantino fan, but I definitely like my Quentin Tarantino in smaller doses than you. And this was a smaller dose, and it was very optimistic and fun and kind of upbeat, and I was so about it.
Again, too many movies to talk about. If you want to see all of our reviews, they're at NOFS Podcast. But before we go, I have to give a huge set of thanks to some really cool fiends, new patrons, Alyssa, Nicholas, Fox, Brandon, Michelle, Jay, Oliver, RJ, Nicole, and Ellen. Now look, I know you guys are all brand new homeowners. You all bought new semi-detached on Birch Street.
We're keeping that.
And, you know, unfortunately, Elm Street, given its reputation, has become kind of a ghost town. And, you know, if I were Freddy, I'd get bored too. I still think it was a little out of school for him to take the Elm Street and the Bird Street signs and swap the two, but unfortunately, that's what you're saddled with. The home inspector couldn't account for it, the property manager couldn't account for it, and these, like, it's not included in your condo fees, but it's definitely something you're gonna have to pay for with your lives.
Somebody's been watching a lot of HGTV. Thank you guys again for your support. Welcome to the Fiend Club. There's tons of bonus content waiting for you at patreon.com/nightmareonfilmstreet. If you aren't supporting the show, head there and check out all of the awesome perks and fun happenings to all of our Patreon supporters.
Thank you.
We didn't talk about Halloween at all.
Oh yeah, by the way, if you are a patron and or if you want to become one before next week, we will have a brand new Drive Home from the Drive-In of David Gordon Green's Halloween.
You're really selling it.
I am really looking forward to seeing that movie again. I know we were, not blown away by it at TIFF, but I'm excited to see it with Packed House. I'm excited to see it again with all of my expectations and all of the hype just completely washed away. Now I can just look at it for fun.
Yeah, I'm excited to hear how everybody feels about it, but not like initially. I want to hear everybody's opinions 1 month from now.
Yeah, you got to let that.
I want the like December Christmas break opinions when you're like full and tired. And you're like, you know what? Yeah, I liked it.
You know, yeah. Now that I think about it. Yeah. Those are the opinions I always want, now that I think about it, opinion. In fact, that should be a new segment on the website. We should revisit movies
Wait
that
a minute.
We loved or hated. Yeah.
That was good.
What the what?
But let's get into these remakes.
Did you know a young boy drowned here? He was my son. And today is his birthday.
Hey, I'm not from around here, but I'm looking for my sister. She's gone missing. Have you seen her?
Jane missing. She's dead. People go missing around here, they're gone for good.
Get out of here. Come on, you guys.
Oh, my God.
This place is called Camp Crystal Lake.
So, Friday the 13th from 2009. Currently sitting at a 5.6 out of 10 on IMDb, 25% on Rotten Tomatoes, 2.4 out of 5 on Letterboxd. And a 2 out of 4 from Roger Ebert, who reviewed it himself.
How did you feel about this movie going in? Like, where did you think you were on the Friday the 13th remake camp?
The first time I saw it, or just before this, for this podcast?
In memory, like, where were you stand going into watching it again for this podcast?
Oh, I've always liked this movie. I have kind of made it a point to defend this movie for a long time. And I never really understood why people hated it so much. I guess I can see where some of the complaints are. It's maybe a little too clean for a Friday the 13th movie. It doesn't really feel like a summer camp so much. Just some kids at a cottage, but that doesn't really not sound like Friday the 13th. And I never really understood any of the issues people had with Jason. I've always liked this movie.
Yeah, I don't necessarily think people are as negative about this movie as you think, though.
Oh.
Because anybody that I've talked to, at least now, maybe after so much time has passed, people are kind of a little warmer to it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's thanks in part to the Evil Dead remake, because that came out in between the Friday the 13th and the Nightmare on Elm Street remakes. And now we had the Evil Dead remake, which everybody loved and kind of brought us on board to like, oh, remakes can exist and not tarnish what came before it.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, it's opened up windows now. We have the Halloween movie and we have the Predator movie. There's movies coming out now that are respectful of their predecessors, but they're still bringing us something new. And I don't know if we would have had that without Fede Alvarez's Evil Dead. I think it even retroactively is making people see these early 2000s remakes with like different light. Like, oh yeah, you know what? That Friday the 13th remake had some interesting ideas and it's not trampling on, you know, Jason's camp.
No, not at all. I think this one's actually really respectful of the franchise. When I watch this, it looks like somebody who actually enjoys all those previous movies and wants to at least maybe give a nod to some of them. For anybody else who's in the theater that grew up watching them.
Yeah, and it definitely feels like it's very respectful of those movies, but it's trying to deliver that Friday the 13th feeling to a younger generation.
Yeah.
It's not for people who fell in love with the films in the 80s, unfortunately.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of where you get that cleaner tone and that cleaner look and those like weird early 2000s belly tops is because it's for that younger generation to get their own slasher movie. Because mm-hmm. slashers had kind of been a little tired at that point and we weren't really making them. So this movie gets to be a kind of run-of-the-mill slasher because it's the first one for people born in 1993.
Yeah. I mean, if this is your first Friday the 13th movie, I don't think that's really the end of the world. Maybe it doesn't help that it's like a pure R-rated movie, so the only people that are gonna see it are people that have some sort of background with the Friday the 13th franchise.
I don't know. I never had any issue seeing movies I wanted to see when I was a teenager.
We're in Canada. Like, if we were born in the States, we would not have seen this movie until we were at least 18.
Is that true, though? Can't you just, like, get an older brother to take you?
I mean, maybe,
or a friend's older brother?
What if you didn't have an older brother?
Then you sneak
or
in.
Any friends.
You buy tickets to Monsters, Inc., and then yeah. You go in Halloween. Like, that's what you do.
I mean, we've all done that, and we've all been kicked out of movies.
So I have never been kicked out of a movie.
I got kicked out of Kill Bill.
You did?
Yeah.
Lame.
Which is weird because
did you have your beard then?
I did, but it was detachable and I forgot it at home. No, Kill Bill was like a hard R here, and you absolutely could not see it unless you were 18. It didn't matter if you were with somebody who was, and at the time I was 17 and a friend of mine was 18. Didn't think it'd be a big deal. By the time the second one came around, it was 18A, and if you knew somebody who was 18, you could get in no problem, but by that time I was also 18, so it was no big deal.
Wow. I saw the like later Scream movies with my grandpa. I saw the Scary Movie movies with my grandpa.
Those I think a lot of those ours. Were they? I thought a lot of them were 14A, which is what the majority of R-rated films in the States become in Canada.
Oh, I don't know.
So as long as you're 14, you're good to go.
I was not 14. I was like 9 and 10.
I can only, well, I mean, you're with your grandpa. It's no big deal. But
yeah, like, how are you going to say no to a grandpa bringing a girl to a horror movie?
Like, it really doesn't matter what the movie is. Be like, yeah, sure, do it,
they're cool.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. I can only remember a small handful of movies that were like solid R's. American Psycho was definitely one of them. But I'm pretty sure that this movie was also 18A. Probably due to how many boobs there are in it.
There are so many boobs
there's
in this
movie. There's a lot of boobs.
And like boobs for not necessarily always horror reasons. I mean, normally you get boobs in movies because it's transgressions. So people are being punished for their premarital sex. And this film definitely touches on it, especially in the first kind of segment.
Mm.
But later on in the movie, there's this really long sex scene and
This sounds
really terrible to say, but nobody dies in it, and it felt like I was being gypped.
Yeah, I mean, like, they definitely, I guess they're sort of subverting that expectation, right? It's like having your character look in a mirror, look down, look back up, and
there's
nothing
no jump
there.
Scare. And
oh,
you're like,
wow.
Oh.
Clever. Yeah, exactly. It sort of like lulls you into that. And I think that's something that they try and do a bunch in these Platinum Dune remakes, that they have all of those stereotypical moments and they show them to you, but you don't get the scare or the kill that you're expecting to happen. And you're right, in that big, long sex scene, there's plenty of opportunity for them to die. And it just doesn't come. Like, Jason's even looking at them, and he's just like, oh, damn it, they're having sex. They know how much I hate that. And instead, he goes off and kills somebody else. And we keep cutting back to this couple. And I wonder if it's because we have the killer cut. I assume it has more footage. Like, the DVD leads me to believe that we are watching a extended cut of the film.
But it's also one of those early DVDs, so you don't really have any options or quality. The quality of that DVD was not great.
No, not really at all. We're getting so spoiled now, right? Like, soon enough, we're going to have 4K and 8K, and the DVDs are just going to continue to look worse and worse. But we're always going to have our VHS. What's up with that?
So I have to say something, though, because I'm not one of those, like, Blu-ray elitists. I do not opt for Blu-rays over DVDs because I simply do not care. I wear glasses, and I don't have 20/20 vision. So, like, as long as I can read the captions when I want to read captions, the movie is in good enough quality for me. But this one was kind of funny because, like, it was like the film overlay wasn't lined up perfectly. So there was, like, especially with the warning at the very beginning, there was this weird blur on it. And I was like, this is not my eyes. This is this DVD.
Yeah, it's such a. I'm sure we got it for $5 at a Walmart bin or
oh,
something.
Oh, probably. But it was also an early DVD, right? Because it doesn't have any fun features. And all the trailers were in a weird aspect ratio. Like, are you guys new? What are these trailers doing this small?
Well, to really date this DVD we own, at the top it says widescreen edition. So this was back when you had a choice between widescreen and the proper letterboxed format. Gross.
I don't care.
You would watch the letterboxed version on a widescreen TV?
Yeah.
If you had the choice of watching it in widescreen?
Yes.
Why?
Because I really love that shitty pan that they have to do when there are scenes that don't work in full screen. You know, where they have to manually pan the footage?
No, I know. I'm just not
computer
I'm
pan,
not making eye contact with
pan
you right
computer,
now.
Please, now. Must see both characters in set.
All right. Well, talking about the film, I say this a lot about a lot of movies, but I love the cold open in this movie. I actually think it's probably one of the best openings in the franchise. I'm going to say it. I don't care. I absolutely love the opening of A New Beginning. I think it's so, so good. I love the cold opens in, like, Jason Lives, I think, has a great one. It's, like, such a fun way to start the movie. But the opening of the 2009 remake is in itself a full movie. Like, we get an entire Friday the 13th film in 17 minutes.
So, and that's, I kind of think it's almost too long to call it the cold open. I would say your first act is a movie.
That's a good point.
I mean, you're right, because it is still the cold open. The title comes up after, mm-hmm. But you're so lulled into these characters, and I think that's where it really succeeds, is that we know the formula, mm-hmm. So we already start putting our tropes on the characters that we're given on these teenagers. We've already know our final girl. We know our this. We know our jock.
We've got our sympathetic boyfriend, and we've got the couple who's definitely going to die having sex in a tent.
Yeah, and we know the order too, and they start dying too quickly. Like, and even you're like,
whoa, did we just lose three people? Like, I haven't even seen a title card yet.
Well, and then you get kind of worried. You're like, oh, I don't want him chasing the final girl around for an hour and 45 minutes. I'm going to be tired. It's just so smart that it subverts what you know is going to happen. It does what you know is going to happen. But the real trick is that it does it so fast that once everybody's dead, the movie starts.
Yeah.
And those aren't even your characters. Mm-hmm. So you invested emotion into them because you know you're supposed to, and you're doing your due diligence as an audience member to fall for those characters.
Yeah.
They're not your characters.
Not at all. And, you know, maybe part of the problem with the movie is that some of the deaths at the beginning are the best in the movie. Like, I wouldn't say that anybody else in the rest of the film that gets killed by Jason is nearly as good as what we see in the opening. Like the girl that's put in the sleeping bag and put over the fire, the kid who gets his foot caught in the bear trap when right before Jason puts a machete down his face, and especially the boyfriend who gets pulled down through the floorboards in Jason's cabin. Oh man, that's one of my favorite kills of the entire franchise, hands down.
Yeah, and this film succeeds to be, like, really gory in that 2008 way where it doesn't even shock you because it's so loud.
What do you mean?
Like, it's just, I don't know how to say it's clean when there's, like, tons of blood everywhere, but it's, there's, like, an action overlay on top of all the horror.
Okay, I see what you're saying. It's got that Michael Bay effect.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like a robot did it.
Yeah. Like a Transformer. Of course, we've got the brother who's from Supernatural. The worst hair in the world. I can't not stare at his hair this entire movie. He's got, like, this wingtip thing happening because he rides a motorcycle, you know. He's got that windswept
hair.
He's
got that good bad boy thing going on.
That
it's
good
fine,
bad
John.
Boy.
And also, it was the hair of the time. What I really, really don't like, though, is the super cool, this is my family's cabin, don't touch the coffee table boyfriend.
The group needs a Chad.
Or is he a boyfriend? Is he her boyfriend? Because he's really possessive and mean to her. But then she also just
Sounds like a shitty boyfriend.
Yeah, but then she also just dicks off and is like, I'm gonna help him find his sister, so fuck you. And then he's like, well, fuck you, I'm gonna sleep with your friend.
Yeah.
Within the span of an hour or two, it's just like, this is a dysfunctional marriage.
And the worst part is, like, that's that big sex scene that we're talking about. She comes pounding on the door, not necessarily because she wants them to stop, but because, hey, we're all in trouble and we need your help.
There's a murderer outside, and they're like, what's that? Like, yeah. And then they just start banging harder, and it's just like, you're really disrespectful. You have been caught-iff.
Caught-iff. Well, I guess they're jerks and it's making it better, but whatever.
Why is your friend a jerk?
Alcohol?
You need better friends.
Well, yeah.
I mean, I guess she has to now because they're all dead.
How do any of these people get along? They don't. None of them look like they would even know each other. We've got, like, this dumbass stoner kid who's hanging out with the super cool rich guy who's got a cottage that he doesn't want anybody to touch.
And he's not even nice to them.
No one. He's nice to no one.
Yeah, he's not even nice to the girl he's sleeping with. Until he's, like, sleeping with her, and then he's like, I like your tits. But other than that, he's pretty mean to everyone.
Which I think is why it's such a shitty move that he doesn't die while they're having sex. Because, like, he's reached the peak of just absolute asshole, and he gets away with it.
Yeah,
for a little while.
But there is a really rewarding scene. So after Jason is definitely inside the house, or, like, in around the windows, the girl that he sleeps with is murdered, and he gets his dad's gun at some point, hears a sound, shoots through the bathroom door to which she is impaled and hanging,
yeah,
shoots through her, and then when he opens the bathroom door, she's dead of maybe a bullet wound.
Yeah, I think in his mind, he thinks he killed her.
Yeah, and he closes the door, he's like, she's dead. He got to her.
Yeah, we gotta go. No one goes through that door.
Yeah, I love that. I know he didn't kill her, but the fact that he was just so gun happy there and he realizes he actually shot through her.
He shoots at everything, too. He is the absolute wrong person to have a gun.
No, he should not be the leader of the pack. He is the loose cannon of the group.
Mm-hmm. Of course, it is pretty great when I think he's trying to get away in his car and Jason stops him and he screams like a little girl. It's pretty great. And I mean, like, his death is pretty good. He thinks he's fighting off Jason. He's getting pretty close to escaping. And Jason impales him on the back of a tow truck.
Yeah, and then the car drives away. So it's like he gets out, but dead already.
And fuck. I completely forgot. His death is so brutal before he gets impaled because Jason puts his machete through him and then lifts him up with the machete and just starts wiggling him around. So yeah. It's pretty great.
Gross.
That's another good kill, actually. God damn, this movie's got good kills. I love the Jason in this movie. He's huge, and he is that human-type Jason. Like, yes, he's got, like, superhuman-type strength, and he seems to be unstoppable, but he's just a man. He's just a boy who grew up in the woods by himself, and I guess has been working out. Like, how do you get to be the size of a barn?
Lifting canoes!
I guess he built his own bunker.
Yeah, this is a really cool Jason, and it definitely explores a side of the franchise that the original thread doesn't really get to explore, because they kind of set up that Jason is this supernatural thing from the get-go.
You really think that they do that in the first three?
Well, in the first movie, he like enrobes the final girl as this zombie boy.
Good point.
When he should be an adult at that point. So you're already seeing Jason as a bit of a supernatural being, even if you're right, in the couple first few sequels, he's mostly man. But this one, he is actually all man. He survived and has been living in the woods and has this crazy-ass setup. And he's almost like feral.
Mm-hmm. And the whole town seems to know about him. Nobody wants to help him. I wonder how long they've known about him, right? Because
it's kind of Cropsy-esque.
Yeah, like he comes into town, he steals some cans of food, maybe some kerosene, but he doesn't hurt anybody unless they get in his way or they steal his weed. Whose weed is that, by the way?
I don't know.
Because somebody's planted it. They're definitely dead. And when that kid finds it, I don't think Jason necessarily comes to kill him because the kid's stealing the weed.
No, I think it's like a territorial thing.
Yeah, it's like you came into my land. But I wonder if he's also coming back because somebody's been stealing kerosene from that property that the kid's on. I wonder if it's just that he happened to be there when Jason came by to steal more kerosene.
Mm.
And if he hadn't have been hanging out, smoking weed, licking porn. He's so gross. Then maybe he would have lived. That kill is kind of strange to me, because I don't really know why Jason shows up, but it does give him an excuse to have a hockey mask. And I'll argue, more of an excuse than having a hockey mask in Friday the 13th Part 3. He's got no reason to grab that hockey mask from Shelley in Part 3. Really no reason at all.
Yeah, there's something really interesting about the mask that doesn't work in the original franchise that works in this franchise, because, I mean, I'm not saying it doesn't work in the original franchise. I think it looks amazing. Mm-hmm. But on a thematic level, this one introduces the idea of shame. The fact that Jason Voorhees is ashamed of his face, why else would you wear a mask? If you're a human being who's murdering people, you put on a mask. It's almost like you're doing them a favor before you murder them that they don't have to see your face.
Yeah. And he only grabs it because his bandage mask is torn off while he's killing this kid in the attic, which is something I don't think anybody like really appreciates about this movie. We get two Jasons. We get like Baghead Jason, a cool ass looking Baghead Jason, like Invisible Man type level Jason. And then like a cool ass hockey mask Jason.
Yeah, I mean, the hockey mask is a little worn and weathered in a movie style way and doesn't look like a mask you'd find in the attic, but you know what? It looks pretty cool.
I mean, everything in that attic looks like it's been up there for 100 years or so.
Yeah, you're right.
That attic is essentially an antique shop that hasn't been open for business
yet. Yeah. But yeah, the shame thing, like,
it's
that
a good point.
That is a really interesting vulnerability that you'd think would alter your perception of Jason, but I think for the Jason that they made for this film, it's such an interesting aspect.
Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, the second half of this movie isn't nearly as interesting as anything we've talked about. It's really long.
Yeah, I mean, and you do kind of follow that these two people can't be injured because they're our protagonist kind of thing. But they do subvert that too, because our final girl, or who we think is our final girl,
yeah,
does meet her end by Jason, and the guy Smallville's
sister.
Oh, isn't he from Smallville? No, he is from Supernatural. His sister is being held captive by Jason because she reminds him of his mother,
which is great. She sort of realizes that at some point, and she's able to get his attention. Like, when she finally uses his name, it really startles him.
Yeah, I'm a little sad that they didn't use the sweater in this one, and it was a locket, because I think there's something about the sweater that's so just memorable and cool.
Mm-hmm.
And Mother's voice is always really cool. Like, the Jason, what are you doing? I wanted a little more of that, but the fact that they kept that kind of connection between the two of them
mm-hmm.
was a really smart idea.
Yeah. I unfortunately don't know that the ending has really earned too much. I'm talking about like that the final moments. We, you know, they're battling Jason, things don't look so great. They wrap a chain around his neck, throw it into a wood chipper, and he's able to fight it off just long enough to have the back of his head clawed open.
Mm-hmm.
Like the machine sort of shorts out before it has the chance to pull his entire body in, but it's enough to kill him, finger quotes here, quote unquote, kill him. And
then they roll him into the lake.
Yeah.
And at this point, it's like, he's a human who's killed a bunch of humans. Like, maybe call the police and don't touch the crime scene.
Yeah, why are you trying to cover up a murder that is definitely
a self-defense murder?
Yeah, but you, by taking that body down to the lake and dumping it, you're immediately making it look like you killed everybody, including that guy.
Yeah, and you're like, we're going to pin it on this guy, but we're going to hide the body so nobody gets the evidence. Like, just leave things and drive into town. It's time to drive into town.
It does give you the chance to see Jason jump up out of the water through the dock at her, which is cool.
Yeah, that's a great ending. But why are they fucking pouring him into the lake? Like, we know that ends up bad for everyone. You have just, congratulations, you have just turned him into the zombie he wasn't.
That's a good point.
Why does everybody keep trying to drown Jason?
I don't know.
Maybe it was the murders.
He really didn't deserve any of this. I guess there were the murders, but
Are there any scenes that we missed out on that you wanted to talk about?
I would think the scene on the boat is another really cool scene. One, because he puts an arrow through that kid's head.
Oh, yeah, that's a nice surprise.
Yeah, that's really good. It's a callback to a great kill that everybody loves. But we also have a girl who's stuck out on the water. She's been hit in the head by the boat because she got run over a little bit. Avoided that propeller,
luckily. Over a little bit.
Yeah, just a little bit. Just enough to be ready for a hospital visit, but she can't get out of the lake because Jason's standing at the shore with a machete. And that's great, because she has no idea what the fuck's happening.
Yeah, but he's fucking spooky, so like...
Yeah, can you imagine turning around seeing that shit?
Yeah, and she just has to tread water, and you're right, and she's just injured, so there's something really foreboding about that scene.
Yeah, but when he finally gets her too, because she's hidden under the dock to try and get away from him, he slams that machete down through the dock into her head, and it's a small little detail, and unfortunately, I think they only do this so that way we can see her naked one more time.
I know.
Where, like, he pulls the machete up, and, like, her whole body comes with it, and...
Gets stuck, yeah.
Yeah, like, he has to use the bottom of the deck to sort of get it, to get the machete out. It looks great, looks awesome, her eyes go, like, dead immediately in this really interesting way. We're kind of fucked up. Unfortunately, it's probably just to see her naked again, which sucks. There is a story that I've always heard that Michael Bay walked out of the premiere of this movie because it was too gratuitous with its sexual content, and that's always sounded hilarious to me because it's Michael Bay, but I can see how that's 100% true. This movie is a little over the top. From moment one, we have this couple behind her friend's back, rubbing oil all over herself, and then we watch them have sex in the tent a bunch. There's that couple that has sex for literally half an hour in the movie.
Yeah, and I want to believe that it's an intentional kind of nod to how slashers are.
Yeah, yeah.
But it doesn't feel ironic all the time.
No, it kind of feels like an excuse to have boobs.
Yeah, and you want it to feel ironic, especially if you're trying to do something a little meta.
Yeah. It doesn't come off as like a horror trope. It just comes off as gratuitous.
Mm-hmm.
Rewatching it this time, I definitely don't think I liked it as much as I remember liking it. And I think that's just because the second half is quite a bit slower. But I still think it's a really good remake. Probably one of the better ones that Platinum Dunes did. We're about to talk about one that I also have feelings about. But for Friday the 13th, I think I'm going to give it a 2 out of 4 Eberts.
Cool. I'm going to go 2.5 out of 4 Eberts. I thought it was really fun.
Yeah, it is.
I'm so excited about how my business is growing. But along with it, my daily life has gotten crazy, like managing my employees and taking sales calls, all while driving my kids to school, soccer practice, and trying to keep my head on straight. I don't want the growth to stop, and I know we need to create a better online presence to do that, but we haven't written a blog, posted on social media, or touched our website in months. I'm not even sure I know how to move forward, so I just haven't. But then I found The Breezy Company, a monthly marketing service subscription that provides experienced and consistent teams with your most demanding marketing tasks through an efficient and streamlined process. It's so simple. I just chose the plan I needed. They matched me with one of their amazing Breezy team members. They onboarded me, and my company was off to the marketing races. I finally feel confident that I have a team who has my business's back and is working to promote what we do, drive leads to our pipeline, and make our brand look amazing. Now, back to work. The Breezy Company, scalable marketing teams.
Shopify is a global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business and sell more with less effort thanks to the Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/redcircle, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/redcircle now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/redcircle.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
All right, moving on, let's talk about Nightmare on Elm Street from 2010.
Don't fall asleep.
Nothing to worry about. This won't hurt one little bit.
So Nightmare on Elm Street is currently sitting at a 5.2 out of 10 on IMDb, 15% on Rotten Tomatoes, 2.1 out of 5 on Letterboxd, and a 1 out of 4 from Roger Ebert.
So we're in a weird position with this movie. Mm-hmm. I'm going to ask you the same question I did for Friday the 13th.
Okay.
How did you feel about this movie going into it?
Yeah, having seen this movie before and spent plenty of time defending it, I was excited to watch it again. I was like, I remember liking this movie a lot. Like, yes, no, of course, nothing like the original. It's never going to be as good as the original. But I didn't think it deserved all of the complaints that it received.
I was kind of in the same boat. I remember it taking the Freddy character to a different, slightly darker way,
yeah,
which I know a lot of people found as the point of contention with this movie, but it was a change that I liked, and mm-hmm. I think it was fresh, and it made something very haunting about this kind of new Freddy experience. But upon rewatching the film,
yeah,
I think I need to readjust what I thought about it, and mm-hmm. not necessarily in regards to the rapey versus murder switch, but just the execution of the film overall.
I'm with you. Everything changed once we pressed play on that shitty DVD.
Also another really cheap, shitty DVD copy. It didn't hold up for me. And no. I'm really sad because we've defended it for a really long time.
Yeah, but I think our defense has always been like, hey, look, I know, not good. Not awful. Like, I think we did a good job of saying, like, oh, it's not as bad as you say it is. And I will at least say the one thing we could probably continue to defend is that it had some good ideas.
It does have some good ideas, but it's kind of...
The presentation of those ideas is really where it falls apart.
Yeah, so this Freddy Krueger is played by... What's his name?
Jackie Earle Haley,
who has a great Freddy voice. Mm-hmm. I love his Freddy voice. Unfortunately, the design of Freddy, I don't love. I like the idea of making him classic burn scars versus the kind of cartoonized version of the traditional Nightmare on Elm Street series. But they obscured his nose and his mouth a little too much. So from head on, he's got like a dinosaur look. But also when they do close-ups of his mouth when he's saying things, I don't think his lips are able to close fully. And he's forming words that need his lips to close fully.
Well, I think what's happened is that his skin has sort of melted and fused together. I'm sure they looked at actual burn victims for inspiration in the special effects of this, right? Like the whole idea is, to me, is that parts of his skin have fused together from the fire.
Mm-hmm.
So like, yeah, he can't close his mouth all the way.
But he's making M's that need M's. You need to close your lips, and they would shoot the close up of it, and his mouth wouldn't close.
Okay.
So it doesn't look like he's even saying the words he's saying. And I understand he's a supernatural being, but any close-up scene where he was saying something creepy didn't sound like he was saying it, and it didn't really resonate with me because his mouth wasn't able to form the words he was making.
Yeah. And, I mean, his dialogue in this movie is really not great. There's a few great moments of dialogue, but for the most part, it's just him laughing.
Yeah, and it... No, I think the problem, too, is that this Freddy's kind of like all bark, no bite. So when he gets the opportunity to bite, all he's got are these one-liners that are really only well executed from Robert Englund's mouth.
And most of them are taken directly from Robert Englund's mouth.
Yeah, and those one-liners belong to the original franchise's Freddy. The Freddy they've created in this film shouldn't be so sassy and quirky and comedic.
Mm-hmm.
This Freddy is a pervert.
Yeah.
And he's a pervert that's been made evil.
Eviler. I know what you mean.
Yeah, it's so hard to describe. So by the what the parents did to him. And so he was this like shy, quiet, outspoken character when he was alive. Still a pervert.
Mm-hmm.
But when he dies, he shouldn't now become this, like, egotistical comedian. That's not who he was.
Yeah, I think the Robert Englund Freddy really took pleasure in what he was doing and killing kids. He was the Springwood slasher, and he loved it. And then he died, and he had the opportunity to continue those killings.
And be a showman.
Yeah, and, like, in a way that he could have never done in his original form as mm-hmm. a person, right? This guy is just out for revenge. Like,
yeah.
It's like, you ruined my life. You killed me. This is your comeuppance.
Yeah, like, you think I damaged your kids then. Watch me damage them now.
Yeah, well, I mean, and the other thing is that they spend a lot of the movie doing a...
mystery search.
Yeah, well, yeah, mystery search, and also we are supposed to assume he didn't actually do it. Like, this is a satanic panic situation where the parents have either made their kids
admit that he did these things to them at their preschool.
That he maybe didn't do, right? Mm-hmm. Like, either they're elaborating on just little details the kids are giving, or they've put words in their mouths, like, from past life regression therapy.
Yeah.
Kind of garbage from that time era.
Both outcomes would have been great. If mm-hmm. he hadn't have done it, you would have had this really interesting Freddy that was made evil by the acts of the parents.
I love that idea.
And then what they went with is that, oh yeah, he actually did it, and he's bad through and through, and now he's worse.
Mm-hmm.
And I like that too. I like that they took Freddy to this almost like unforgiven place. But that's why the tone doesn't work. He doesn't get to be a funny Freddy, and he doesn't get to be this like quirky. Because immediately, as soon as you involve like child assault, we're not on his side. He's not our anti-hero. He's not the bad guy that we love to hate or hate to love. Like, we just don't like him anymore.
Which is so interesting about the original Nightmare on Elm Street. Like, yeah, he killed a bunch of kids, but he didn't touch them.
You know, like, I mean, I always kind of secretly assumed that Freddy was into kids.
I think that was the plan.
And I think that was the inspiration behind Freddy Krueger. It was never explicitly, like, used in the franchise, but... I mean, we all kind of know that Freddy's into children. He's into them in a way that's not okay.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, murdering them, I guess. Yeah, that's also not okay. It is crazy when you're like, yeah, he murders the children, but he does not rape the children. But when he's like got new Nancy, in the bed, and he's got the like baby doll dress on her, and he's touching her with his claw, and he's saying all these like supposed to play for yucks lines.
How do you laugh at that?
I'm really uncomfortable, and I want it to stop. And it also shows that he doesn't have the bite, like I was saying, because that scene is really long because he's just taunting her and stuff. And it's like, Freddy, just kill her if you're gonna kill her.
Yeah, or just do something. Because well, like his big thing is we got all the. Well, no, but I mean, stop talking. Either we need her to be rescued sooner, or you need to start like cutting off her finger, like just like a little bit at a time, right?
Yeah, he's too taunting, and it's just almost like waiting, like we're waiting for the story to advance while he's got her captive, and it just shows that he's not fully articulated.
Yeah, it makes for a much darker I'm your boyfriend now, Nancy line.
That I'm your boyfriend now line really worked, but that was the only thing that worked in that scene.
Agreed. It's crazy. And you know what really bugged me? Having rewatched it now, there's a lot that bugs me about this movie. But just kind of like focusing on whether or not he did it or if he was innocent and yada yada. When they find his bedroom in the bottom of that elementary school, they still think he didn't do it. They're still like, oh, this is where he lived and he was just a guy. On his desk are these claws that he's been fashioning. I don't believe that quiet teacher, who is sort of like your invisible pedophile that goes by completely unnoticed.
He's the maintenance guy, but yes.
Maintenance guy, I'm sorry.
Those are for hedges.
Is that the excuse?
Yeah, they're hedge hands.
They look... You know, there was this one time where I saw a hairdresser who had fashioned some sort of, like, sharp claws onto his hands, and that's how he was cutting hair. It was just kind of, like, running his fingers through people's hair and then just, like, slicing it, like, where it needed to finish.
No, whatever.
So I'm sure somebody out there around the 80s was probably trying to sell a hedge trimmer that you could just swipe at with your hands.
It was Tim Burton.
It was Tim Burton. Good point. I understand how they would still think he's innocent when they find the knives on his table.
And the soiled mattress.
Well, there's that.
Gross basement mattress.
Well, also, I mean, they also find, like, his rape room.
Well, is there no missing persons report? Like, I assume the parents didn't say, like, oh, this guy was diddling our kids and we murdered him.
Yeah.
But he goes missing. Why was that school not emptied? Why is that stuff not bagged in evidence?
And it's not like the police knew, oh, yep, well, this is that pedophile guy. Better left un... you know, better swept under the rug.
Yeah.
The kids, nobody, other than the parents, nobody ever knows what this guy has done. As far as anybody's concerned, he just disappeared one day, right? Exactly. So somebody should have looked for him, which is, I can understand why maybe they wanted to make Nancy's mom a single mom and she doesn't have a dad. But in the original Nightmare on Elm Street, John Saxon is a police officer, and that's how they got away with it.
Mm-hmm.
Because he's like the sheriff, he's the chief of police, and he made sure that nobody ever questioned what happened to Freddy Krueger.
Mm-hmm.
Because who's going to care about some pedophile child killer? It doesn't matter. But in this movie, they just kill a guy, they get away with it, nobody asks questions. And
they make this murder pact, and then they keep all the fucking evidence. Like, all the parents have their own evidence, like, stuffed in corners and boxes and
sure,
drawers.
Sure, they've removed all those photos from their family albums, but it's up in the attic for anybody to find.
Yeah.
Jeez, have you never seen a Netflix documentary?
Who keeps evidence of the murder?
any evidence. I don't understand why they didn't burn the elementary school down.
I know. Mistakes made.
Like, whether or not the maintenance guy's there anymore, you probably don't want your kids going there because it's just a bunch of bad juju.
Yeah. And it's crazy that none of these kids remember, but whatever. I guess trauma. Also, they're all banking on that trauma just erasing their memories.
Yeah, like, oh, you know what, kids, you know, kids are resilient. They'll bounce back from this. They'll just forget about it entirely.
Yeah.
You were actually born as a 6-year-old boy, Timmy. Nothing ever happened between the ages of 0 and 6.
I do also have to say that I don't love Nancy in this one.
Yeah.
I like Rooney Mara. I think she's a really great actress, especially when she's well cast in her roles. Mm-hmm. I don't know if I love this Nancy.
Mm-hmm.
She's resourceful and inquisitive and a little headstrong and almost a little bratty in the original one.
Oh, okay. I was like, is she resourceful in this?
She's in way over her head. This one comes off as like quiet and brooding, and I don't really care about her as much.
And then just immediately at the end when it's convenient, like, no, I'm gonna fight him. Like, you have no plan. You have nothing going for you.
You're kind of quiet and just like walking through this whole movie.
Yeah, like, I'm gonna make it out of this one. You're like, why? Because it's a movie and I'm the last girl left. Like, at least Heather Langenkamp goes, I cannot fight this guy. It's an unfair match. I'm gonna rig up the entire house because I can't fight him with my own two hands. Like, she just sets a bunch of booby traps to try and weaken him and kill him.
Yeah, and what's interesting about Nancy in the first one is, like, once she's put in this situation, like, her character has no choice but to fight him because that's who she is.
Mm.
And you know that about her. Like, you just understand that this Nancy, the original Nancy, is this headstrong, like, she's gonna do it.
I'm just really into survival, I guess.
I'm just really into survival. The Rooney Mara Nancy is just this, like, sad, tortured artist who can't fall asleep.
Yeah.
And that's kind of it. So I'm not, her hair's too perfect and it's not frizzy and I'm, like, not about it. But
it's 2010, Kim. No one's got frizzy hair.
Yeah.
Freddy, too, is apparently trying to get them to remember.
Yeah, so there's this weird kind of, like, plot that the characters themselves are forcing on us that I don't necessarily get from the story itself. They're like, this is why he's been leading us here. And it's like, has he? Because he's been killing all your friends. Like, why is he just leading the two of you there? Everybody else is dead.
That's the weird part. Like, they find a blog of some kid who is also having these nightmares. Like, another kid from the preschool who's moved on to go somewhere else. He, in his nightmares, is explaining that it's like Freddy is corralling him into this school and he's got to investigate the school, but he doesn't know why he's there. Then he gets killed on screen and I guess Freddy uploads the video. But if he wants them to remember, he kills so many of them before they figure it out. Like, literally only Nancy and whatever the boy's name is, our new Johnny Depp, like, whatever, those two characters are the only two that actually figure any of it out.
Yeah.
And in this one, rather than fear being what gives him power, it's their memories of him, which I guess you could say is fear because they have all these memories of their trauma and being abused by him. But it doesn't make sense. Like, he should not have he should not have enough power to attack them now because he hasn't gained any from the other kids that he's killed.
Yeah. He ignores the rules a little bit because they want to pay, like, homages to the first film. So at one point, Nancy's so tired in this one when they're running through the halls to get to somewhere, she sees her friend in the body bag scene, which looks okay. It looks cool. I'm glad they put it in. You can't ignore that scene. But she's not asleep.
No.
And the guy just, like, shuffs it off as saying, like, oh, you're having micro naps. Like, micro naps are not a thing. I would be a much happier person if they were.
Yeah. I don't know, though. Like, I really like that convenience store scene. I like the idea of the micro naps where, like, you think you're awake, but you're actually sleeping is a cool addition to the movie because you got to do something more with it, I think.
Well, the whole movie, the entire franchise has played on that, like, oh, you think you're still asleep and you walk through a regular area and, oh, no, it's you're in Freddy's land.
But it's not like she falls asleep on the floor in the convenience store for half a second. Like, she's still, her body is moving backwards, but her brain is asleep is the idea. Like,
yeah.
She's gone into rest mode. I think it's a great scene where he's swiping at the boiler room pipes, but then he's, like, knocking stuff off the shelves.
Yeah.
Like, looks great. I also really like watching that scene from the perspective of the pharmacist. Because in his mind, two drug addicts came into his store, started screaming. One girl cut herself because I guess she thought she'd get medication. And then they just stole bandages from the shelf and ran out the store.
Yeah. Like, should we call security? Like, well, they are gone.
Yeah. What danger? We're not going to refill his prescription. What danger is there?
Yeah, they have his full name, too. So
that kid does not help at all trying to get that prescription refilled. He hasn't been asleep for days. He's sniffling. He's angry. And he needs his uppers now. Who's going to say yes to that kid?
Yeah.
Even if he had refills left in the store. Yeah. Not going to happen, bud.
A few things I did like, though. There are some really cool moments within homages when Nancy's running away from Freddy and the ground turns into like liquid goo.
Yeah.
In kind of the steps of the first film,
yeah.
We get that where the hallway turns completely to liquid and she's engulfed in it and she almost drowns in it. I think it's blood, but
yeah,
it looks really good. And yeah. I like that they went there with that and they didn't necessarily do the exact same thing.
Mm-hmm.
Also, the scene where she... Actually, I think that's the same scene where the ceiling implodes from above.
Yeah, because she's fallen... She has drowned in that blood.
And it's almost like it explodes out into her bedroom.
Yeah.
Which it doesn't work out for the shape of the house or whatever. But, I mean, dream logic, it's fine. Yeah. Everything is dream logic in this. But when she explodes out of it, it's almost like it was recorded backwards. So when she comes out, she's not covered in blood at all.
Mm-hmm.
And she's like flip spinning on the ceiling and then she lands in the bed.
Mm-hmm.
It looked really cool with the blood explosion thing. It was a little like impossibly... done. It was a little CGI-y because there's no other way you could have done it.
Yeah.
But I still really liked it.
It looked all right. Yeah. It looked like liquid in space.
It was cool. It was a surprise is why I liked it.
Yeah. I mean, it kind of looks similar to the blood explosion from Johnny Depp's bed in the original. It's what it made me think of. But it's different enough that it's its own thing.
Mm-hmm.
I would say... this movie has too many homages to the original, and they don't really work all that well. I don't necessarily love the bathtub sequence in this movie.
No, because it doesn't do the cool stuff that the original one does, and if it did, it would have been too much.
I would have been happy with that scene in the trailer and not in the movie.
That would have been cool.
That would have been all right.
If the teaser trailer was just that scene of his claw coming up and then going down when the mom knocks on the door, that would have been a really awesome teaser trailer.
Yeah.
Don't need it in the movie.
Exactly. That's kind of what people want to see in a teaser trailer. They want to know that it's at least in the same vein as the one I already like. But show me something new when I finally sit down to watch it. And Tina's death is... nothing close to the original at all.
No, I mean, they do all the things that they're supposed to do. She's on the ceiling, whatever, but it's too fast and it's not impactful.
No, there's something about... I mean, it's not that there's something. Like, we all know exactly why that original death is so scary. She's being dragged across the wall. It's not that she's just being tossed around the room from side to side. Like, he's swinging her like a mallet. It's really weird looking and impossible, and it's like that nightmare dream logic put into the real world.
Yeah, and you're watching it from the perspective of the boyfriend, so you're seeing it with these eyes that have no idea what's going on, and this thing that is in front of you is impossible, and also your girlfriend is dying and you're completely helpless.
Yeah.
That is your perspective as the audience in that scene.
Exactly.
In this one, you're watching her being thrown around.
Yeah, and then she dies.
Yeah, and then it's over.
I don't like the cold open in this movie as much as Friday the 13th, but I still think it's good.
The color is really cool.
That's what I was going to say. Yeah, like those sequences where he's in the dream and like the open sign is flashing against, I guess it's the hours in the window. There's just a red light and a green light flashing back and forth. And it's like you are getting so in the mood for this movie.
Mm-hmm.
I think his death is cool where he kind of like he cuts
his own throat. That's great.
Brutal. It's brutal. It looks good.
And I think it's the right amount of shock for the opening to the film. Unfortunately, it doesn't live up to the hype it sets up. But that tells you like, you think Nightmare on Elm Street is this fun dreamlike romp. Like, but we're going to kill some kids today.
Mm-hmm. No, they kill a bunch of kids. But yeah, it's just it doesn't get Freddy. And it tries to make Freddy different, but it totally doesn't. It just misses the mark on it. Like, they want to make him something completely different, but then they want him to live up to the original. And then it's... The tones are really strange.
Yeah.
They really make a villain that we can't
like.
Appreciate. Yeah.
And that's the thing, too, is that you can't please everyone. So if you're going to step away from something, you have to go full step. You have to just go for it and hope that the people that do appreciate it, like, get the decisions that you made.
Yeah.
You want to try to make your own original thing. And I think taking Freddy to that dark place, making him the pedophile, and playing, if Freddy was this socially awkward, quiet, like, creep.
Mm-hmm.
And I say creep, like, Freddy, early Freddy is a creep, but he's kind of like a fun, cool creep. If this Freddy was, yeah, like socially underdeveloped, I would have been so into that.
Yeah. It could have been like was it Night of the Scarecrow, that TV movie where they kill the simple kid in town and he comes back to kill them all as the Scarecrow. It would have been something like that, maybe. I mean, if they had wiped the movie of all humor or all attempts at humor and chuckles, then our Freddy probably would have been a little better. And then maybe, you know, people would have complained that, like, oh, this isn't a Nightmare on Elm Street.
This isn't Freddy.
Yeah.
But you would have had that anyways. You have that now.
But you would have had a character that was true to himself from what you showed us in the movie, at
least.
It's unfortunate. He's too big and powerful for what they're trying to make him to be in this. And you're right. Like, I think a timid, awkward one would have been such a weird choice and something completely different that it would have felt fresh and new and not just... the looking glass version of the original. Like, this is just a weird mirroring that gets almost everything wrong.
Yeah. So
sad.
Unfortunately, I'm going to go 1 out of 4.
I'm also giving this a 1 out of 4.
Yeah. And I, going into it, I thought I was going to be more 2.5, 3 even. Did not hold up for me.
Yeah. Like, I was expecting... to really defend this movie.
Yeah, I thought really we were going to be like, oh man, this is going to be an unpopular episode. We have different opinions than everybody. But guys, we were wrong. You guys were right. This is not a great movie.
Yeah.
We're so, so sorry.
We apologize.
but let us know if you liked this movie, if you revisited it recently and you thought it was underrated. Tweet at us at NOFS Podcast, or you can sound off in our Facebook group. That is facebook.com/groups/horrorfiendsofNOFS.
We are controlling transmission.
Yee-hoo! Having trouble with a lily?
This week's episode of Nightmare on Film Street is brought to you by Deadly Grounds, coffee to die for. Made from 100% Arabica beans, Deadly Grounds is horror-themed gourmet coffee without any fancy names or titles. This week's blend is the caramel biscotti-flavored Toxic Toffee. It's Deadly Grounds' delicious house blend exposed to high levels of caffeinated radiation, a dash of caramel, and a pinch of toffee. We're just kidding about the radiation, by the way. But head over to getdeadly.ca right now to pick out your brew and get 15% off at checkout when you use the promo code NIGHTMARE. That's promo code NIGHTMARE at getdeadly.ca for 15% off your entire purchase. We're going to stick around for a little while and play a game that I've put together. I was originally going to call this Basements and Boiler Rooms.
I like that.
Yeah, but I've taken a page out of our horror trivia nights at Deadly Grounds, and I'm calling this one, Whose Lair Is It Anyway?
That sounds like it's going to be really fun. You can hear that episode over on Patreon right now at patreon.com/nightmareonfilmstreet. In exchange for supporting the show, you're also going to get cool shout-outs and merchandise and some other cool perks. So definitely check that out. Supporting the show really helps us each week with all of our overhead, running the website, and all that stuff. And we are totally, solely supported by you guys that listen out there. So thank you guys so much.
Yes, the show would be nothing without your support, and that goes to you as well, even if you are not a Patreon supporter. If you could take the time to give the show a 5-star rating, recommend it to a friend that you think would enjoy the show, a fellow fiend, help us grow the horde, that would be greatly appreciated.
Yeah, even simple things like liking posts on social media and sharing and stuff. We totally appreciate everybody that takes the time to help Nightmare on Film Street grow, because this is above anything. It's a community, and it's a community space, and we want it to be for everybody, except for bad remakes. I'm kidding.
But that's it from us this week. I'm John.
Kim.
Stay creepy.
It appears you made it out alive. Just long enough to tell the tale of the Nightmare on Film Street. Ow! Help us grow the horde. Leave a review on iTunes or wherever you subscribe. Continue this week's conversation on Twitter by following at NOFS Podcast. And as always, more terror can be found lurking on our website, www.NightmareOnFilmStreetPodcast.com. Until next week, stay creepy, fiends.
Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at Cenovus.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.